You danced for him and none other, Cotillion went on. Not even the adjunct.
I expected to die.
I know.
She waited. Faint voices from the camp beyond the flimsy walls. The occasional glow of a hooded lantern swinging past. The thud of boots. A silence stretched.
You saved us, she finally said. For that, I suppose, I have to thank you.
No, Lastara Yil, you do not. I possessed you, after all. You didn't ask for that, but then, even all those years ago, the grace of your dance was breathtaking.
Her breath caught. Something was happening here. She didn't understand it.
If you did not wish my gratitude, Cotillion, why are you here?
Even as she spoke, she flinched at her own tone's harshness.
That came out all wrong.
His face remained hidden.
Those were early days, weren't they? Our flesh was real, our breaths real. It was all there, in reach, and we took it without a moment's thought as to how precious it all was. Our youth, the brightness of the sun, the heat that seemed to stretch ahead forever.
She realized then that he was weeping, felt helpless before it.
What is this about? I took your anger, you said.
And yes, she could remember it, the way the power filled her. The skill with the swords was entirely her own, but the swiftness, the profound awareness, that had belonged to him.
I took your anger. Cotillion, what did you take from me?
He seemed to shake his head.
I think I'm done with possessing women.
What did you take? You took that love, didn't you? It drowned you, just as your anger drowned me.
He sighed. Always an even exchange.
Can a god not love?
A god forgets.
She was appalled.
But then what keeps you going? Cotillion, why do you fight on?
Abruptly he stood.
You are chilled. I have disturbed your rest.
Possess me again.
What?
The love that I feel. You need it, Cotillion. That need is what brought you here, wasn't it? You want to drown again.
His reply was a frail whisper.
I cannot.
Why not? I offer this to you as a true measure of my gratitude. When a mortal communes with her god, is not the language love itself?
My worshippers love me not, Lastara Yil. Besides, I have nothing worthy to give in exchange. I appreciate your offer.
Listen, you shit! I'm trying to give you some of your humanity back. You're a damned god. If you lose your passion, where does that leave us?
The question clearly rocked him.
I do not doubt the path awaiting me, Lastara Yil. I am strong enough for it, right to the bitter end.
I don't doubt any of that. I felt you, remember? Listen, whatever that end you see coming, what I'm offering is to take away some of its bitterness. Don't you see that?
He was shaking his head.
You don't understand. The blood on my hands
is now on my hands, too. Or have you forgotten that?
No, I possessed you.
You think that makes a difference?
I should not have come here.
Probably not, but here you are, and that hood doesn't hide everything. Very well, refuse my offer, but do you really think it's just women who feel love? If you decide never again to feel anything, then best you swear off possession entirely, Cotillion. Steal into us mortals and we'll take what we need from you, and we'll give in return whatever we own. If you're lucky, it'll be love. If you're not lucky, well, Hood knows what you'll get.
I am aware of this.
Yes, you must be. I'm sorry, but Cotillion, you gave me more than your anger. Don't you see that? The man I love does not now grieve for me. His love is not for a ghost. a brief moment in his life that he can never recapture. You gave us both a chance to live and to love. It doesn't matter for how much longer.
I also spared the adjunct, and by extension, this entire army.
She cocked her head, momentarily disoriented.
Do you regret that?
He hesitated, and that silence rippled like ice water through Lostara Yil.
While she lives, he said, the path awaiting you and this beleaguered, half-damned army is as bitter as my own. To the suffering to come, ah, there are no gifts in any of this.
There must be, Cotillion. They exist. They always do.
Will you all die in the name of love?
The question seemed torn from something inside him.
If die we must, what better reason?
He studied her for a dozen heartbeats and then said,
I have been considering amends.
Amends? I don't understand.
Our youth, he murmured, as if he had not heard her. The brightness of the sun. She chose to leave him because I fear of me, of what I did to her. It was wrong, all of it, so terribly wrong. Love, I'd forgotten.
The shadows deepened, and a moment later she was alone in her tent.
She, Cotillion, listened to my prayer. For all your fears, love is not something you can forget, but you can turn your back on it. Do not do that.
A god had sought her out, a god suffering desperate need, but she couldn't give him what he desired. Perhaps, she saw now, he'd been wise in rejecting what she'd offered.
The first time it was anger for love, but I saw no anger left in him. Always an even exchange. If I opened my love to him, whatever he had left inside himself, he didn't want to give it to me.
And that, she now comprehended, had been an act of mercy.
The things said and the things not said. In the space in between, a thousand worlds, a thousand worlds.
The parish escort of two armored, helmed, and taciturn soldiers halted. The one on the left pointed and said to Bottle,
There, Marine, you will find your comrades. They have gathered at the summons of their captain.
To Masan Gilani and Ruthan Gud, the soldier continued,
The adjunct's command tent lies elsewhere. But as we have come to the edge of the Bonehunter encampment, I expect you will have little difficulty in finding your own way.
Much as we will miss your company, Ruthan Gud said, I am sure you are correct. Thank you for guiding us this far, sirs.
The figures, Bottle wasn't even sure if they were men or women, and the voice of the one who'd spoken gave no hint whatsoever, bowed and then turned about to retrace their routes. Bottle faced his companions.
We part here, then. Masan, I expect I'll see you soon enough.
Captain,
he saluted smartly. The man scowled in reply. Gesturing to Masan, he set off for the heart of the camp. Bottle faced the direction the guard had indicated.
What sort got to say to them, then? Guess I'm about to find out.
They'd set no pickets. A small mass of soldiers were seated or standing in a basin, and at the far end, hunched down on a boulder,
Is that Fiddler? Gods below, don't tell me this is all that's left!
Tentatively, he approached. They made their own way through a relatively quiet camp. It was late and Masan was not looking forward to rousing the adjunct, but she knew Tavare would not abide any delays to any of this.
Though my report probably won't impress her. 5 beat-up Tlani Mas is all I've got to show.
No, it was Ruthan Gud who was marching into a serious mess. She hoped she'd be witness to at least some of that exchange, if only to revel in the captain's discomfort.
Elder, well, I won't tell. But all the rest you did, Captain, now that sounded interesting. Too bad I missed it.
They passed through a few groups here and there, and Masan sensed a heightening attention from those faces turned their way. But no one accosted them. No one said a damned thing. Strange and stranger still. They came to within sight of the command tent. Two guards were stationed at the flap, and the glow of lantern light painted the canvas walls.
"Does she ever sleep?"
Ruthengard wondered in a drawl.
"In her boots," Masan replied. "I doubt I would."
The eyes of the guards were now on them, and both slowly straightened, their shadowed gazes clearly fixing on the captain. Both saluted when he halted before them.
"She probably wants to see us," Ruthen said.
"You have leave to enter, sir,"
one of them said. As the captain moved to the entrance, the same guard said,
"Sir?"
"Yes."
"Welcome back."
Masan followed him inside.
"Of all the luck," muttered Ruthengard upon seeing a dozing Scannero.
He held a hand to stay Masan.
"Please," he whispered, "don't wake her."
"Coward," she mouthed in reply. Grimacing, he edged past the sleeping woman. As she neared, Masan's gaze fell to one wayward booted foot, and she gave it a kick. Scannero bolted upright.
"Adj! Gods below!"
That shout rang loud as a hammered cauldron. At the very threshold to the inner chamber, Ruthengard wheeled. Whatever he intended to say, he had no chance, as Scannero was upon him in an instant. Such was the force of her lunge and embrace that he staggered back, splitting the curtain into the adjunct's presence. Scannero held her kiss as if glued to the captain's mouth. Grinning, Masan Gilani edged in behind them, caught the adjunct's astonished gaze. Tavare was standing beside a small folding map table. She was otherwise alone, accounting for her half-dressed state. Only the quilted undergarment of her armor covered her torso, and below that, nothing but loose linen trousers, the knees so stained they'd have embarrassed a farmer. Her face was strangely streaked in the half-light of a single oil lamp.
"Adjunct," Masan Gilani said, saluting. "On my return journey, I happened upon the captain here and a marine named Bottle from Fiddler's squad."
"Scannero!"
The word was sharp as a blade.
"Disengage yourself from the captain. I believe he has come here to speak to me. As for the rest, it will have to wait."
Scannero pulled herself from Ruthengard.
My apologies, adjunct. With your leave, I will wait outside."
"You will not. You will return to your tent and wait there. I trust the captain will find it without much trouble."
Scannero blinked, and then, fighting a smile, she saluted a second time, and, with one last glance at Ruthen, a look that was either a glare or a dark promise, she was gone. Ruthengard straightened before the adjunct and cleared his throat.
"Adjunct."
"Your act, captain, on the day of the Naruk, broke enough military conventions to warrant a court-martial. You abandoned your soldiers and disobeyed orders."
"Yes, adjunct."
"And quite possibly saved all our lives."
She seemed to become cognizant of her attire, for she turned to the tent's center pole, where a robe hung from a hook. Shrugging into the woolen garment, she faced Ruthen again.
"Entire tomes have been devoted to a discussion of these particular incidents in military campaigns. Disobedience on the one hand and extraordinary valor on the other. What is to be done with such a soldier?"
"Rank and discipline must ever take precedence, adjunct."
Her gaze sharpened on him.
"Is that your learned opinion on the matter, captain? Content, are you, with distilling all those tomes in a handful of words?"
"Frankly, adjunct, yes."
"I see. Then what do you suggest I do with you?"
"At the very least, adjunct, reduce my rank. For you are accurate and proper in noting my dereliction of responsibility regarding the soldiers under my command."
"Of course I am, you fool."
She ran a hand through her short hair and caught Masan's gaze. The Dalhanese could not help but see the faint gleam in those unremarkable and clearly tired eyes.
"Very well, Ruthengard. You have lost your command. Your rank, however, shall remain unchanged, but from this day forward, you are attached to my staff. And if you imagine this to be some sort of promotion, well, I suggest you sit down with Lastara Yil sometime soon.
She paused, eyes narrowing on Ruthan Gud.
Why, Captain, you seem displeased. Good. Now, as to other matters that we should discuss, perhaps they can wait. There is one woman in this camp, however, who cannot. Dismissed.
His salute was somewhat shaky. When he was gone, the adjunct sighed and sat down by her map table.
Forgive me, Marine, for my improper state. It has been a long day.
No need to apologize, adjunct.
Tavare's eyes traveled up and down Massan, sending a faint tremor through her spine.
Oh, I know that kind of look.
You look surprisingly hale, soldier.
Modest gifts from our new allies, adjunct.
Brows lifted.
Indeed?
Alas, there are only 5 of them.
5?
Talani Mas, adjunct. I don't know if they were the allies you sought. In fact, they found me, not the other way round. And it is their opinion that my bringing them here was the right thing to do.
The adjunct continued studying her. Massan felt trickles of sweat wending down the small of her back.
I don't know. She's a damned skinny one.
Summon them.
The figures rose from the dirt floor. Dust to bones, dust to withered flesh, dust to chipped weapons of stone. But T'Lani Mas bowed to the adjunct. The one named Baroque then spoke.
Adjunct Tavare Paran, we are the Unbound. We bring you greeting, adjunct, from the crippled god.
And at that, something seemed to crumple inside Tavare, for she leaned forward, set her hands to her face, and said,
Thank you. I thought, out of time, too late. Oh gods, thank you.
He'd stood unnoticed for some time. Just one more marine there on the edge of the crowd, holding back, unsure of what he was witnessing here. Fiddler wasn't saying anything. In fact, the bastard might well be sleeping with his head sunk down like that. As for the soldiers in the basin, some muttered back and forth, a few tried to sleep but were kicked awake by their companions. When Fiddler lifted his gaze, the marines and heavies fell silent, suddenly attentive. The sergeant was rummaging in his kit bag. He drew something out, but it was impossible to see what. Peered at it for a long moment, and then returned it to his satchel.
Cuthel?
Aye.
He's here. Go find him.
The sapper rose and slowly turned.
All right, then, he growled. I ain't got the eyes of a rat, so show yourself, damn you.
A slow heat prickled through Bottle. He looked round. Fiddler said,
Aye, Bottle, you, don't be so thick.
Here,
Bottle said. Figures close to him swung round then. A few muffled curses, and all at once a space opened around him. Cuttle was making his way over, and even in the gloom his expression was severe.
I think Smiles sold off your kit, Bottle,
he said as he arrived to stand before him.
At least you scrounged up some weapons, which is saying something. You all knew. Knew what? That you survived? Gods no, we all figured you dead and gone. You think Smiles would have sold off your stuff if we didn't?
He could see the rest of the squad drawing up behind Cuttle.
Well, yes.
The sapper grunted.
Got a point there, soldier. Anyway, we didn't know a damned thing. He just made us sit here and wait, is what he did.
I thought this was Faradan Sort's meeting.
Fids, Captain, now, Bottle.
Oh.
And since he's now a captain, official and everything, he's got decorum to follow.
Right.
Of course. I mean, so instead of him doing this, it's me.
And with that, the veteran stepped close and embraced him, hard enough to make Bottle's bones ache. Cuttle's breath was harsh in his ear.
Kept looking at a card, you see. Kept looking at it. Welcome back, Bottle. Gods below, welcome home.
Stormy halted the Vergath, grainy-eyed, aching, He stared at the massed army seething in motion on the flats below as the dawn sliced open the eastern horizon. Bone hunter standards to the left, companies jostling to form up for the march, far too few companies for Stormy's liking. Already assembled and facing southeast, the Lethary legions, and with them Perish ranks and the gilt standards of some other army. Scowling, he swung his gaze back to the bone hunters, positioned to march due east.
Gods below.
A scattering of Cundrill outriders had spotted him, two setting off back to the vanguard, while a half dozen, bows drawn and arrows nocked, rode swiftly in his direction. Seeing their growing confusion as they approached, Stormy grinned. He lifted one hand in greeting. They pulled up 30 paces away. The ranks of the bone hunters were all halted now, facing in his direction. He saw the adjunct and a handful of officers emerging from the swirling dust near the column's head to ride towards him. He considered meeting them halfway, decided not to. Twisting round, he looked back at his Kel Hunter escort and the drones. Weapon points were buried in the hard ground. The drones had settled on their tails, tiny birds dancing on their hides and feeding on ticks and mites. From them all, a scent of calm repose.
Good. Stay there, all of you, and don't do anything unnerving.
Horses shied on the approach, and it was quickly apparent that none of the mounts would draw within 20 long strides of the Vigath. Across the gap, Stormy met the adjunct's eyes.
I'd dismount, he said, but I think my legs died sometime in the night. Adjunct, I bring greetings from mortal sword Gessler, Destriant Callis, and the Gunthan Kachain Chemal.
She slipped down from her mount and walked towards him, slowly drawing off her leather gloves. The Naruk, Corporal, was seeking their kin, correct?
Aye, estranged kin, I'd say. Saw no hugs when we all met.
If Sergeant Gessler is now Mortal Sword, Corporal, what does that make you?
Shield Anvil.
I see. And the god you serve?
Damned if I know, adjunct.
Tucking the gloves in her belt, she drew off her helm and ran a hand through her hair.
Your battle with the Naruk?
Malazan tactics, adjunct, along with these beasts, gave us the upper hand. We annihilated the bastards.
Something changed in her face, but nothing he could work out. She glanced back at her officers, or perhaps the army waiting beyond, and then once more fixed her gaze upon him.
Shield Anvil Stormy? This creature you ride?
Vigath soldier, adjunct. Only 3 bear these saddles.
And your Kachain Chemal army? I see hunters behind you as well. There are more of these Vigath?
My Kachain Chemal army.
Aye, lots. We got a bit mauled, to be sure. Those sky keeps gave us trouble, but some unexpected allies arrived to take them down. That's what I'm here to tell you, adjunct. Sin and Grub found us. There was someone else, too. Never figured out who, but no matter, nobody climbed down out of the Azath when it was all done with, so I doubt they made it.
He'd just thrown enough at her to confuse a damned ascendant. Instead, she simply studied him and then asked,
Shield Anvil, you now command an army of Kachain Chemal?
Aye, and our 2 runts are saying they have to stay with us unless you order them back to you.
No.
Stormy cursed under his breath.
You sure? They're handy, don't eat much, clean up after themselves, mostly. Well, occasionally. But with plenty of back-of-the-hand training, why, they'd shape up.
Fist Keneb is dead, she cut in. We have also lost Quick Ben and most of the Marines and the Heavies.
He winced.
Them short tails was bleeding when they found us, but what you're saying tells me you could do with the runts.
No, you will need them more than we will.
We will? Adjunct, where do you think we're going?
To war.
Against who?
Whom, Shield Anvil? You intend to wage war against the Fokrul Asael?
He grimaced, glanced at the fist and captains positioned behind the adjunct. Blistig, Lostara Yil, Ruthen Gud. That miserable ex-priest half slumped over his saddle. His attention returned to the adjunct.
Now, why would we declare war on the Forkral Ursale?
Ask the runts. Stormy sagged.
We did that. They ain't good on explanations, those two. Grub's the only one between them who'll say anything to us at all. Oh, Sin talks just fine when it suits her. Me and Guess, we was hoping you'd be more, forthcoming.
A snort from Blistig. Tavare said, Shield Anvil, inform Mortal Sword Gessler of the following. The Perish, Lethary, and Balkando armies are marching on the spire. It is my fear that even such a formidable force will not be enough. The sorcery of the Asael is powerful and insidious, especially on the field of battle.
Is it now, adjunct?
She blinked and then said, I have spent 3 years amidst the archives of Unta, Stormy, reading the oldest and obscurest histories drawn to the capital from the further reaches of the Malazan Empire. I have interviewed the finest scholars I could find, including Heboric Light Touch, on matters of fragmented references to the Forkral Ursale. She hesitated and then continued. I know what awaits us all, Shield Anvil. The three human armies you now see marching into the southeast are vulnerable.
Where the Kachain Jemal or not?
She shrugged. Could we conjure before us, here and now, a Forkral Ursale? Do you imagine it could command your Vergath to surrender its weapons, to kneel? Stormy grunted.
I'd like to see it try. But what of the runts?
Safer in your company than in ours. He narrowed his gaze on her.
What is it you mean to do with your bone hunters, adjunct?
Split the enemy forces, Shield Anvil.
You have taken a savaging, adjunct,
and have been avenged by you and your Chemal. She took a step closer, dropping her voice. Stormy, when news of your victory spreads through my army, much that haunts it now will fall silent. There will be no cheers. I am not such a fool as to expect anything like that. But at the very least, there will be satisfaction. Do you understand me?
Is Fiddler?
He lives.
Good.
He squinted at her.
You've a way of gathering allies, haven't you, adjunct?
It is not me, Stormy. It is the cause itself.
I'd agree if I could figure out what that cause is all about.
You mentioned a destriant.
I did.
Then ask that one.
We did, but she knows even less than we do.
Tavare cocked her head. Are you sure?
Well, she gets little sleep. Nightmares every night.
He clawed fingers through his beard.
Oh, hood take me.
She sees the fate awaiting us all should we fail, Shield Anvil. He was silent, sinking back, crossing 1,000 leagues of memory and time. Days in Arran, ranks milling, recalcitrant faces, a desperate need for cohesion.
Armies are unruly beasts. You took us, you made us into something, but none of us knows what, or even what for.
And now here she stood. A thin, plain woman, not tall, not imposing in any way at all,
except for the cold iron in her bones. Why did you take this on, adjunct?
She settled the helm back on her head and fixed the clasps. That's my business.
This path of yours,
he asked, resisting her dismissal.
Where did it start? That first step, when was it? You can answer me that one, at least.
She regarded him. Can I?
I'm about to ride back to Gessler, adjunct, and I got to make a report. I got to tell him what I think about all this. So give me something.
She looked away, studied the formed up ranks of her army. My first step? Very well. He waited. She stood as if carved from floored marble, a thing in profile, weeping dust. But no, that sense was emerging from deep inside his own soul, as if he'd found a mirror's reflection of the nondescript woman standing before him, and in that reflection a thousand hidden truths. She faced him again, her eyes swallowed by the shadow of the helm's rim. The day, Shield Envil, the Paran family lost its only son. The answer was so unexpected, so jarring, that Stormy could say nothing.
Gods below, Tevere.
He struggled to find words, any words.
I did not know your brother had died, Adjunct.
He hasn't,
she snapped, turning away. Stormy silently cursed. He'd said the wrong thing. He'd shown his own stupidity, his own lack of understanding.
Fine. Maybe I'm not Gessler. Maybe I don't get it.
A jellied breath seemed to flow through him then.
Adjunct!
His shout drew her round.
What is it?
He drew a deep breath and then said,
When we join up with the Perish and the others, who's in overall command?
She studied him briefly before replying,
There will be a Prince of Lether, a mortal sword of the Grey Helms, and the Queen of Bolkando.
Hoot's breath! I don't...
Who will be in command, Shield Envil? You and Gessler.
He stared at her, aghast, and then bellowed,
Don't you think his head's swelled big enough yet? You ain't had to live with him.
Her tone was hard and cold.
Bear in mind what I said about vulnerability, Shield Envil, and be sure to guard your own back.
Guard what?
One last thing, Stormy. Extend my condolences to Grubb. Inform him, if you think it will help, that Fist Keneb's death was one of singular heroism.
He thought he heard a careful choosing of words in that statement.
No matter. Might help as much as shit can with that stuff. Worth a try, I suppose. Adjunct?
She had gathered the reins of her horse and had one foot in the stirrup.
Yes?
Shall we meet again?
Tavare Paran hesitated, and what might have been a faint smile curved her thin lips. She swung astride her horse.
Fare you well, Shield Envil.
A pause, and then,
Stormy, should you one day meet my brother?
No, never mind. With that, she drew her horse round and set off for the head of the column. Blistig wheeled in behind her, as did Ruthen Gard and then the ex-priest, although perhaps with him it was more a matter of a mount content to following the others, leaving only Lostara Yil.
Stormy?
Lostara?
Quick Ben was sure you and Gessler lived.
Was he now?
But now we've lost him.
He thought about that and then grinned.
Take this for what it's worth, Lostara Yil. He figured we were alive and well. He was right. Now, I've got this feeling he ain't so lost as you might think. He's a snake. Always was, always will be.
The smile she flashed him almost made him hesitate, but before he could call out something inviting and possibly improper, she was riding after the others.
Damn, smiles like that don't land on me every day.
Scowling, he ordered his Vergath round and then set off on the back trail. The hunters and drones fell into his wake. One of the tiny birds tried landing in Stormy's beard. His curse sent it screeching away. Book 3. To Charge the Spear. And now the bold historian wields into play that tome of blistering worth, where the stern monks cower under the lash, and through the high window the ashes of heretics drift down in purity's rain. See the truths stitched in thread of gold across hapless skin. I am the arbiter of lies, who will cleanse his hand in copper bowls and white sand. But the spittle on his lips gathers the host to another tale. I was never so blind to not feel the deep tremble of hidden rivers in churning torrent,
or the prickly tear of Quill's jab. I will tell you the manner of all things in sure proof this ordered stone row. Oh, spare me now the speckled fists, this princeps purge and prattle. I live in mists and seething cloud, and the breaths of the unseen give warmth and comfort to better the bleakest days to come, and I will carry on in my uncertainty, cowled in a peace such as you could not imagine. A Life in Mists, Gothos. Chapter 8. Whatever we're left with can only be enough if in the measure of things nothing is cast off, discarded on the wayside, in the strides that take us clear beyond the smoke and grief into a world of shocked birth, opening eyes upon a sudden light. And to whirl then in a breath to see all that we have done, where the tombs on the trail lie sealed like jeweled memories in the dusk of a good life's end, and not one footprint beckons upon the soft snow ahead, but feel this sweet wind caress. A season crawls from earth beneath mantled folds. I have caught a glimpse, a hint of flared mystery, shapes in the liquid glare. They will take from us all that we cradle in our arms, and the burden yielded makes feathers of my hands, and the voices drifting down are all that we're left with, and shall forever be enough. You will take my days, Fisher Kel'tath.
To slither beneath the fists of the world.
Her name was Thal, a quiet one with watchful, sad eyes. Bursting from the cloud of shards, her screams sounded like laughter. The devouring insects clustered where her eyes had been. They lunged into her gaping mouth, the welters of blood from shredded lips drawing hundreds more. Sadik cried out his horror, staggered back as if about to flee, but Badal snapped out one hand and held him fast. Panic was what the shards loved most, what they waited for, and panic was what had taken Thal, and now the shards were taking her. Blind, the girl ran, stumbling on the jagged crystals that tore her bared feet. Children edged closer to her, and Badal could see the flatness in their eyes, and she understood.
Strike down, fists. Still we slide and slither. You cannot kill us. You cannot kill the memory of us. We remain, to remind you of the future you gave us. We remain, because we are the proof of your crime. Let the eaters crowd your eyes. Welcome your own blindness, as if it was a gift of mercy, and that could well be laughter. Dear child, you could well be laughing, a voice of memory, of history even. In that laugh, all the ills of the world. In that laugh, all the proofs of your guilt. Children are dying, still dying, forever dying.
Thal fell, her screams deadening to choking, hacking sounds as shards crawled down her throat. She writhed and then twitched, and the swarm grew sluggish, feeding, fattening. Badal watched the children close in, watched their hands lunge out, snatching wallowing insects, stuffing them into eager mouths.
We go round and round, and this is the story of the world. Do not flee us. Do not flee this moment, this scene. Do not confuse dislike and abhorrence with angry denial of truths you do not wish to see. I accept your horror and expect no forgiveness. But if you deny, I name you coward. And I have had my fill of cowards.
She blew flies from her lips and glanced at Rut. He clutched Held, weeping without tears. Beyond him stretched out the terrible flat waste of the glass desert. Badal then turned back to study the snake, eyes narrowing. Torpor unsuited to the heat, the brightness of the sky.
This was the sluggish motion of the exhausted.
Your fists beat us senseless. Your fists explode with reasons. You beat us out of fear, out of self-loathing. You beat us because it feels good. It feels good to pretend and to forget. And every time your fist comes down, you crush a little more guilt. In that old place where we once lived, you decried those who beat their children. Yet see what you have done to the world. You are all beaters of children.
Badal,
said Rut.
Yes, Rut.
She did not face him again, not yet.
We have few days left. The holes of water are gone. We cannot even go back. We will never make it back. Badal, I think I give up. I'm ready to give up.
Give up? Will you leave Held to the shards, to the opals?
She heard him draw a sharp breath.
They will not touch Held,
he whispered.
No, they won't, will they? Before Held became Held,
she said,
Held had another name, and that name was Born. Born came from between the legs of a woman, a mother. Born came into this world with eyes of blue, blue as this sky, and blue they remain. We must go on, Rut. We must live to see the day when a new color finds Held's eyes, when Held goes back to being born.
Badal,
he whispered behind her.
You don't have to understand,
she said.
We don't know who that mother was. We don't know who the new mother will be.
I've seen at night,
he faltered then.
Badal, the older ones, yes,
she replied.
Our own mothers and fathers, lying together, trying to make babies. We can only go back to what we knew, to whatever we remember from the old days. We make it all happen again, even though we know it didn't work the first time. It's all we know to do.
Do you still fly in your dreams, Badal?
We have to go on, Rut, until Held stops being Held and becomes born.
I hear her crying at night.
Her. This is her story. Born becomes Held. Held becomes Mother. Mother makes Born. Born is Held. And the boys who are now fathers, they try to go back, back inside. Every night they try and try. Rut, we all cry at night.
We need to walk,
she said, turning to face him at last. His visage was crumpled, a thing of slack skin and ringed eyes, broken lips, the forehead of a priest who doubts his own faith. His hair was falling out. His hands looked huge.
Held says west, Rut. West.
There is nothing there.
There is a great family, and they are rich in all things, in food, in water. They seek us to bless us, to show us that the future still lives. They will promise to us that future. I have seen it all, and there is a mother who leads them, and all her children she holds in her arms, though she has never made a born. There is a mother, Rut, just like you, and soon the child in her arms will open its eyes. I dreamed of Held last night, Rut.
You did?
Yes, she had wings and she was flying away. I heard her voice on the wind.
Her voice, Badal? What was she saying? What was Held saying?
She wasn't saying anything, Rut. She was laughing.
Frost limned the driftwood heaped along the strand, and the chunks of ice in the shallow waters of the bay crunched and ground as the rolling waves jostled them. Falash hacked out the last of her morning cough, and then, drawing her fur-lined cloak about her shoulders, she straightened and walked over to where her handmaid was building up the fire.
Have you prepared my breakfast?
The older woman gestured to the strange disc of sawn tree trunk they were using as a table, where waited a mug of herbal tea and a lit hookah.
Excellent. I tell you, my head aches. Mother's sendings are clumsy and brutal. Or perhaps it's just Omtos Falak that is so harsh, like this infernal ice and chill plaguing us.
She glanced over at the other camp, 30 paces along the beach, and frowned.
And all this superstition, tipped well over the edge into blatant rudeness, in my opinion.
The sorcery frightens them, Highness.
Ha! That sorcery saved their lives! You would think gratitude should trump petty terrors and imagined bugaboos. Dear me, what a pathetic gaggle of hens they all are.
She settled down on a log, careful to avoid the strange iron bolts jutting from it, sipped some tea, and then reached for the hookah's artfully carved ivory mouthpiece. Puffing contentedly, she twisted to eye the ship frozen in the bay.
Look at that. The only thing keeping it afloat is the iceberg it's nesting in.
Alas, Highness, that is probably the very source of their present discontent. They are sailors stranded on land. Even the captain and her first mate are showing their despondency.
Well, Falash sniffed, we must make do with what we have, mustn't we? In any case, there's nothing to be done for it, is there? That ship is finished. We must now trek overland, and how my feet will survive this I dare not contemplate.
She turned in her seat to see Shurkalal and Skorgan Kaban approaching, the first mate cursing as he stumbled in the sand.
Captain, join me in some tea. You too, Skorgan, please.
She faced her handmaid.
Fetch us more cups, will you? Excellent.
Beru bless us,
Skorgan hissed.
10 paces away and the heat's melting us where we stand, but here...
That will fade, I am sure, said Falash. The sorcery of yesterday was, shall we say, rather intense. And before you complain overmuch, I shall observe that my maid and I are no less discomforted by this wretched cold. Perhaps the Jaghut were delighted to dwell within such a climate, but as you can well see, we are not Jaghut.
Shurkalal said, Highness, about my ship. Falash drew deeply on her mouthpiece.
Yes, she sighed, that. I believe I have apologized already, have I not? It is perhaps a consequence of insufficient education, but I truly was unaware that all ships carry in their bellies a certain amount of water, considered acceptable for voyaging, and that the freezing thereof would result in disaster, in the manner of split boards and so forth. Besides, was not your crew working the pumps?
As you say, Shurk said. But 100 hands below deck could not have pumped fast enough, given the speed of that freezing. But that was not my point. As you noted, we have been through all that. Bad luck, plain and simple.
No, what I wished to discuss was the matter of repairs.
Falash regarded the pale-skinned woman and slowly tapped the mouthpiece against her teeth.
In the midst of your histrionics 2 days ago, Captain, I had assumed that all was lost in the matter of the undying gratitude. Have you reconsidered?
Yes. No. Rather, we have walked this beach. The driftwood is useless. The few logs we found were heavy as granite. Mail knows what they used that damned stuff for, but it sure doesn't float. In fact, it appears to have neutral buoyancy.
Excuse me, what?
Push that wood to any depth you like. There it stays. Never before seen the like. We have an ex-joiner with us who says it's to do with the minerals the wood has absorbed and the soil the tree grew in. In any case, we see no forests inland, no trees at all, anywhere.
Meaning you have no wood with which to effect repairs? Yes, Captain. Was this not your prediction 2 days ago?
Aye, it was. And so it has proved, Highness. And as my crew can't survive on a frozen ship, on the surface of it, we seem to indeed be stranded. Skorgan kicked sand with his good foot.
What's worse, Highness? There's hardly any shellfish and the like in the shallows. Picked clean long ago, I'd wager. We couldn't even walk up the coast to get where you want us to go.
Most disturbing, Falash murmured, still eyeing Shurk Elal.
Yet you have an idea, haven't you, Captain?
Maybe.
Please proceed. I am not by nature averse to adventure and experimentation.
Aye, Highness. Still the woman hesitated. Falash sent a stream of smoke whirling away.
Come now, Captain. Your first mate is turning blue.
Very well. Omtos Falak, Highness. Is it a true hold?
I am not sure what you mean by that question.
A hold, a place, a world unlike this one.
Where?
Added Skorgon.
We might find, trees or something. Unless it's all ice and snow, of course, or worse.
Ah, I see.
She tapped some more, thinking.
The hold of ice. Well, precisely. The sorcery, as we have all discovered, is certainly cold, forbidding even. But if my education suffers in matters of shipbuilding and the like, it is rather more comprehensive when it comes to the holds.
She smiled.
Naturally.
Naturally, said Shurk Elal, to cut off whatever Skorgon had been about to say.
The commonest manifestation of Omtos Falak is precisely as we have experienced. Ice, bitter cold, desiccating, enervating. But it must be understood, said sorcery was shaped as a defensive weapon, if you will. The Jaghut were at war with an implacable enemy, and they were losing that war. They sought to surround themselves in vast sheets of ice, to make of it an impassable barrier. And as often as not, they succeeded, for a time. Of course, as my mother used to delight in pointing out, war drives invention. And as soon as one side improves its tactical position, the other quickly adapts to negate the advantage, assuming they have the time to do so. Interestingly, one could argue it was the Jaghut's very own flaws that ensured their demise. For had they considered ice not as a defensive measure, but as an offensive one, had they made it a true weapon, a force of attack and assault, why, they might well have annihilated their enemy before it could adapt. And while details regarding that enemy are murky...
Forgive me, Highness, interrupted the captain, but as you noted earlier, my first mate is truly suffering. If I am understanding you, the ice and cold of Omtos Falak are mere aspects, or, I suppose, applications of a force. And, as such, they are not that force's sole characteristic. Falash clapped her hands.
Precisely, Captain. Excellent.
Very well, Highness. I am so relieved. Now, as to those other aspects of the hold, what can you tell me?
Falash blinked up at the woman. Why, nothing.
Nothing?
Not a thing, Captain. The only manifestation of Omtos Falak this world has seen has been ice-aspected.
Then how do you know there's more to it?
Captain, it only stands to reason.
So this notion of there being more, it's merely theoretical?
Dearest, that term is not pejorative, no matter the tone you have just employed.
Teeth chattering, Skorgon Caban said,
So I stood here for that? You ain't got a mail-spitting clue?
Hardly accurate, first mate, Falash said. It would hardly have served any of us if I'd simply said, I don't know, would it? Instead, what I have actually said is, I don't know, but I believe this to be a path worth pursuing.
So why didn't you?
He demanded.
But I did.
Shurk Elal turned to Skorgon. That's enough, pretty. Go back to the others.
And tell them what?
We're exploring possibilities. Falash waved one plump hand.
A moment, please. I suggest that you both return to your fellows. The explorations that will occupy me on this day are best done alone, for I cannot guarantee the safety of anyone in close proximity. In fact, I suggest you move your camp perhaps twice its present distance from us.
Very well, Highness, said Shurk Elal. We shall do that. As they marched off, Falash turned to her handmaid. My dear, she murmured, a journey awaits you.
Yes, Highness.
Gird yourself well, Falash advised. Prepare the armor and take the throwing axes. And you will need to swim out to the ship for a splinter of wood. But before all that, I wish a new pot of tea and more rust leaf for this bowl.
At once, Highness.
Gods below,
Shurkalal muttered as they neared the crew's camp.
But she has spectacular tits. It ever amazes me the extraordinary variation blessing us all.
She glanced at her first mate.
Or cursing us, as the case may be.
I wanted to stick a damned knife in her skull, Captain.
Belay such notions and stow them deep and dark. If one of the mates hears you, well, I don't want that kind of trouble.
Of course, Captain. Was just an impulse anyway, like a tick under the eye. Anyway, how could you see her tits at all under all those warm furs and such?
I could see just fine, Shulk replied. It's called imagination, pretty.
Wish I had some of that.
In the meantime, we need to allay some fears, and I expect moving us farther down the strand will put us in good stead right from the start.
Aye, it will.
He scratched at the scars puckering his neck.
You know, Captain, I got me a smell that saying that handmaiden of hers ain't as useless as she's made out to look, you know?
Brewing pots and lighting pipe bowls doesn't count for anything with you, pretty. I tell you, I'm considering finding my own handmaiden once we get home. Of course, she added, there's no rule says it has to be a woman, is there?
A flush crept up the man's misshapen face. Shook clapped him on the back.
You're right about her, pretty. I'm thinking she's as mean a sorceress as the princess herself, and probably a lot more besides. That woman hides herself well, but one glimpse of her wrists... Well, unless she's throwing bales of hay around when no one's looking, and given the scars on her hands those bales got knives in them, well, aye, she's more than she seems.
What's her name, anyway?
No idea.
Shurk grunted. The sailors at the camp were watching them now.
All right, pretty. Let me do the talking.
Aye, Captain. Better you and me.
And if I mess up, you can beat on some heads.
To bring them round, like.
Exactly.
Cool beneath the umbrella, Falash watched her handmaid crawl up from the water.
You need more fat on you, dear, she observed. I'm sure the sun will warm you up soon enough, as it has done me. In any case,
she gestured with the mouthpiece,
the passage awaits you.
Gasping, the older woman slowly worked her way well clear of the waterline. In her right hand was a splinter of wood, black against her bluish knuckles. Behind her, in the shallows, the ice was fast melting as the last remnants of Umtos Felak faded. At the bay's outer edge, where the shelf fell away to deeper water, the undying gratitude was settling lower into a glittering, weeping nest. Once the handmaid had recovered enough to begin moving, she dressed herself in quilted undergarments and then the heavy scaled armor retrieved from bundles of waxed canvas. Taking up the paired throwing axes, a leather-sheathed short sword, an underarm holster of four throwing knives, and her helm, she completed her attire by tucking the wood splinter into her belt.
Highness, I am ready. Well said. My patience was wearing ominously thin.
Sighing, Falash set the mouthpiece down and rose.
Where did you put the last of the sweets?
Beside the brick of rust leaf, Highness.
Ah, I see. Wonderful. See how thin I'm getting? It's an outrage. Do you recall your own childhood, dear, when your chest was flat and all your bones jutted every which way?
No, Highness. I was never boy thin. Thank the errant's nudge.
Nor me. I've always been suspicious of grown men who seem to like that in their women. What's wrong with little boys if they're into pallid, bony wraiths?
Perhaps it appeals to their protective natures, Highness.
Protecting is one thing, diddling is entirely another. Now, where was I? Oh, yes, throwing you into the hold of ice. Best unsheathe at least a few of your weapons, dear. Who knows what you'll land in? The handmaid drew her axes.
I am ready.
That condescending, patronizing cow doesn't deserve tits like that, or that soft, blemish-free skin and lustrous hair. And the way those hips swing, why, I'm amazed she doesn't throw out her back with every step. And those damned luscious lips look ready-made to wrap themselves round. Gods, what was that?
The thunderclap shivered the water in the bay, set the sand to blurry trembling. Shirkalal turned to see an enormous white cloud billowing out and up from Falash's camp. The sailors, well out of earshot behind her, were now on their feet, shouting in alarm.
"Stay here, Scorgon, and calm those fools down," she set off at a run.
The camp was a mess, gear flung about as if a whirlwind had erupted in its midst. Princess Falash was slowly picking herself up from the blasted sand. Her hair was awry, her clothes disheveled. Her face was red, as if she'd been repeatedly slapped.
"Highness, are you all right?"
the girl coughed.
"I believe the theory has proved itself, Captain. It seems there is far more to Umtos Falak than a few chunks of ice. The passage I found, well, it's hard to say where precisely it led.
Where is your handmaiden, Highness?"
"Well, let us hope she is exploring in wonder and delight.
You sent her through?"
A flash from her stunning eyes.
"Of course I sent her through. Did you not insist on the necessity, given our terrible plight? Can you begin to imagine my sacrifice, the appalling extremity of the service we are providing here?"
Shirkalal studied the plump girl.
"What if she doesn't come back?"
"I shall be most displeased. At the same time, we shall have before us evidence to support certain other theories about Umtos Falak."
"Excuse me, what other theories?"
"Why, the ones about shrieking demons, clouds of madness, flesh-eating plants, treacherous voles, and 100 other nightmares in a similar vein. Now, please be so kind as to rebuild my fire here, will you?"
She reached for her last throwing knife, found the sheath empty. Cursing, she ducked beneath the scything slash and threw herself to the left, shoulder rolling until she came up against the bulk of the first fiend she'd slain. Her hands scrabbled up its muricated hide, found the wedge of one of her axes. Grunting as she tugged it free, she rolled over the body. It quivered as six swords punched into it in the spot where she'd been a moment earlier, and regained her feet in time to send the axe flying. It crunched into the demon's brow, rocking its head back. She lunged for it, tugging away one of the heavy swords gripped by the closest hand, which was twitching as the huge beast sagged onto its knees, blade clashing as she beat away the swords flailing about at the ends of the five other arms. She chopped into its thick neck, once, twice, three times, until the head rolled free. Spinning, she looked for more of the damned things. Five corpses and nothing more. Apart from her heavy breaths, the glade was silent. From one fire straight into another, she'd landed in the middle of a camp, and it was her luck that she'd been ready when they clearly were not. The fire burned on here and there, where the hottest embers had scattered. If she was not careful, she'd end up burning down the forest and all the wood the captain and her crew sorely needed. The handmaid retrieved her weapons and then stamped out the smoldering flames. She cursed as something bit into the back of her neck. Scrabbling with one hand, she closed her fist about something small and furry, brought it round for a closer look. A vole with a mouthful of her flesh. Snorting, she flung the thing away.
"Well, Highness," she muttered, "seems I've found some trees."
Some beast shrieked close by, and the cry was echoed by a half dozen more surrounding the glade, drawing closer.
"Errant's bunghole, those things sound vicious."
Pointless hanging around here, she decided. Choosing a direction at random, she ducked into the forest. Absurdly dark, and the air was damp and cold. Plunging forward, she held her axes at the ready.
A shriek sounded directly behind her, and she whirled round. Something skittered on